Okay, guys. Hello. All right. So we're going to pay attention to our speaker tonight. Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you a story. I first met our speaker tonight, 1995, 30 years ago. It was my first time chaperoning at a Steubenville retreat. And if any of you parents have talked to me about what can I do with my kids, I always say, send them to the Steubenville retreat. They get a lot out of it. And it's because of our speaker tonight. He's one of many that I've witnessed do a 180. His parish and my parish, St. Bernard's Parish, rented a bus, drove 14 hours to Ohio and overnight. And I witnessed our speaker tonight just being charming and very charismatic with all the girls on the bus, okay? And I do believe you said you came to get girls' phone numbers. But he went on the retreat, he heard the speakers, he loved the music, and on the way home, his witness was very different. He was on fire for Jesus, and he's been that way ever since. Fast forward to 2021, and because of COVID, the Steubenville retreats were live streaming from Ohio. And as some of you may know, my husband plays guitar at the 9:30 Mass. So he was with a band playing in Newtown for their youth group who was attending the Steubenville retreat. And I get a phone call. And my husband says, Lori, do you know an Oscar from Waterbury? And I said, yes, I know an Oscar from Waterbury. He's the keynote speaker. And I asked my husband, please record some of his talk, and he did. And when I heard it, I could have cried because it was I remember it from the bus. I remember your witness from the bus. I'll tell you about that later. But we are very honored to have Oscar Rivera with us. He is an international speaker. He has a podcast on Ave Maria Press. He's a father. He's a husband and a father, and he works with youth out of Fall River, Massachusetts. So I'd like to introduce to you Oscar Rivera.
Massachusetts. I'm just naturally loud. There we go. Let me start again. Hi, I'm Oscar Rivera. So we have all these things in the house. Now, here's the grand slam right now. Crucifix, Bible, rosary, and some sort of saint statue, and which includes Mary as well. Anybody? Bam. All in the house. My house was a mausoleum of Catholic collectibles. I had all sorts of Bible prints. In fact, if I were to go to Springfield and find Dr. Seuss's family, they'd probably write a whole different book about all the smalls and talls, all the wides and tides of the collection of Catholic stuff that I had. I had every Bible, from the small little Gideon's Bible, y'all know that little one, to the one that I think my dad stole from a hotel. The irony behind that. Right? Then we had a big one that we had to open up very carefully. We had all sorts of Bibles, all sorts of statues. I even had a picture of Jesus in the bathroom. Now, y'all think it's funny now, but this was a holographic image of Jesus, almost 3D. When you moved, his eyes moved. And depending on the angle of your move, it almost looked like he was winking at you. Super awkward, especially when you're contemplating life, if you catch my drift. Didn't like it at all. We had a glow-in-the-dark rosary, and the beads were the size of softballs. They're like this big. We didn't need a nightlight in our place because that rosary lit the room. I was Catholic because I had a lot of stuff to show for it, but I didn't really understand Catholicism at all. Everything about Catholicism kind of threw me off. Here's the catch. My dad was super Catholic. My mom was Protestant. So in the house, there was a lot of Catholic stuff. But when we talked about Catholic stuff, it was always an argument. I never really understood anything Catholic. I was like, man, my mom's telling me I can go straight to Jesus. And my dad's telling me that I have a bunch of people to go through before I can bother Jesus. There was a disconnect. It didn't make sense, and growing up, I got a bit frustrated with it. I ended up meeting a bunch of people from different parts because of the Steubenville Conference that I went on, and one of my best friends that I had was from Cheshire, Connecticut. Cheshire was right close to Waterbury, but we couldn't be any more different. He grew up on the farm. I grew up in the hood. He grew up with the only thing being afraid of was probably like some sort of slasher guy living in the woods, and me was like all the local gangs and stuff. We were very different. And he and I were like the best of friends. He was a tall, very handsome looking man. He kind of looked like Tom Brady before Tom Brady, right? And I, like Danny DeVito. You know what I mean? Just short and round. He had no problem getting a girlfriend. When he went to Steubenville, his notebook came back with tons of phone numbers. Mine, I was in debt. I was in the negatives. So he had no problem. He was a dater. He liked to date. He had girlfriends, no problem. One day he approached me and said, I met the girl of my dreams. I said, nah, bro. Nah, you lying. He goes, nah, this is the one. I go, bro, if you make it a year, then I will go with you to Riverside, which is now Six Flags, right? And I'll get on the slingshot. I was so confident that this dude wasn't going to make it a year that I made that bet. Well, a year later, him and his short girlfriend, who's shorter than me, came up to me and they're like, guess what? I'm like, what? They're like, we're going to Six Flags. I go, why? And then I go, oh, I know why. Crud. He goes, we're going on a slingshot. I go, man, I hate stupid bets. Anybody ever make a bet that they regret? Yeah, because that's one that I definitely regret, right? We drive up to Six Flags and we get on the slingshot. Anybody ever been on the slingshot? No, you know why? Because you have. So it's a giant rubber band. In fact, it even says it in its explanation that it's a gigantic rubber band that shoots a human being like a pebble. Look it up on Six Flags website. We went on this thing, we got strapped in. Here I am in the middle of this love sandwich. This tall dude and this very short girl that I don't think she was even too tall. She wasn't tall enough for the ride, y'all. But she got on it somehow. And here I am in the middle of this thing. And when they pulled us back and they have the tension going, the guy basically was just kind of looking at me because I was in the middle. And he goes, I need you to pull the cord. I go, I ain't pulling nothing. He goes, pull the cord. I go, I'm not pulling it. Like, I was too afraid. I don't know about y'all, but, like, I'm not, like, amusement park. Like, I don't like amusement parks. I'm not a thrill chaser. If God wanted me to fly, he'd put wings on me. Like, I don't do things like that. So going to this amusement park wasn't very amusing. I made a dumb bet that I lost. And now he's telling me, pull the cord. Well, after this, like, hostage negotiation between he and I, he finally said, I'll count you down and you can pull the cord when I get to 10. I said, why such a long count? So he counts, 1. I'm like, bro, can we just make it 5, 2, 3. And then he pulls the cord himself from the booth. I don't know if you've ever screamed so much that you've swallowed your scream and then threw it back up. Has that ever happened to you? Because it's something like, ever happened to you? No? It will. Trust me. And you'll remember this moment where I was right in front of you throwing up my scream. When I started flying, my heart was racing. Everything about my body started getting real tense, but also very loose. And then I started saying dumb things. Like, hey, look at me. I'm a Puerto Rican ostrich. Yeah, it sounds stupid, right? Why did it sound dumb? Does anybody want to tell me why an ostrich in the sky sounds dumb? You know. What's the answer? They can't fly, right? I blame my public school system, right? But here I am screaming out, I'm a Puerto Rican ostrich. I can fly. I said it about 1,000 times to a point when after I got off the ride, people at Riverside was like, look, it's the Puerto Rican ostrich. Because they've heard the scream. But here I am on this freeing ride being shot out. If you've ever been on a roller coaster ride, you'll know that roller coaster rides are going to change the way you think and feel without you even knowing that it's happening. In fact, the minute you get in line for a roller coaster ride, regardless of whether you're a thrill seeker or not, the first few steps aren't a problem. But once you get closer to your destination, your heart starts to race a little bit. And now the game is don't let people see it. When you start to buckle up to get on a ride, your heart has now reached a point of, like, excitement. You're either going to throw up out of excitement or you're going to, like, you're getting real tense. But either way, you're going through a psychological and physical change. Your body is responding to the thrill, or actually, it's more responding to the fear of the unknown. And depending on how you respond to it, it's either you chase it or you don't. But your body does go through a physiological change when it is approached or making its face to face with fear. When you are face-to-face with fear, you end up doing things that you can't control. Your palms get sweaty. Your heart starts beating a little bit stronger. Your muscles start to tense up. Your respiratory system starts to contract and expand on its own. There's a lot of things that are going on. But then when that ride is done, you take a sigh of relief and go, but I didn't die. And if you're bold enough, you'll do it again. Like my kids, I took them to one amusement park, Quasi, down in Middlebury, right? And they were in Quasi Park, and they went on one roller coaster ride, and I thought they were going to be scared to death because I was too scared to go on that as a kid. And they went on it once. And after the fear was over, they kept going on it and going on it and going on it. Because they realized that the fear that they had was nothing to really fear at all. It's the science of fight or flight. What does this have to do with this talk? Is that we live within a generation, within a culture that perpetually is living within the fight or flight mentality. Physiologically, a lot of us are living very wound tight. Connecticut does it better than any state in the whole United States. You can tell by the way we drive, by the urgency of wanting to get from point A to point B, and you can especially tell when you go to the mall just 30 minutes that way with how people are just really tense about a season that they shouldn't even be tense about. But within this tension, it's where we find ourselves. It's where we are going to find what we're truly made of. Our culture, and I'm speaking to the young culture first and foremost, psychologists have determined that you are the most anxiety-prone, stressed-out generation of generations within recorded history. Let me put this in perspective. There are generations here that lived during a Cold War threat where buildings were built on top of bomb shelters because of fear of nuclear threat. And this generation lives more stressed out than that generation. To put this more in perspective, generations before the Cold War generation were individuals that were living within two giant world wars where no one really knew what was going to happen at the end of it all. In fact, I don't know how many of y'all historians out there, but there are documents of Hitler wanting to hit Connecticut. Before he even thought of Pearl Harbor, he thought of Connecticut. Why did he think of Connecticut? Because at the time, we had Smith & Wesson and Colt that were working. They were working ammunition, and the brass city capital of the world was Waterbury, Connecticut. Knock out the heart of ammunition, you knock out the war. You are more stressed out than even that generation. And adults, we're stressed out because of the uncertainty of what our bank accounts might look like, what our political infrastructure might look like, what would that do to my 401k, what would that do to this, that, or the third, the future of my family, and so on. We're all just one big powder keg. We can't deny it. You can hide it and you can filter it. Right? When you go on social media, if you take a picture of yourself and you don't like it, guess what? Find a filter. It'll make you look real cute. You don't like the blemish on your face, just slide left and you get sprinklies everywhere. We live within a culture where we can filter everything, but the reality is that you can filter the exterior all you want, but the interior is what's making things click. And here we are within a season that for four weeks, we are afforded an opportunity to take a deep breath of relief. And we've even made a stress about that. Do I have the presence? Do I have all the gifts? Am I going to forget somebody? Who am I going to offend by not getting a Christmas card to them? Are my kids going to accept my gift or reject my gift? Would they even notice that I got them something? Would they even notice all the hours that I put in to work for that one thing? It continues. For 4 weeks, we're afforded an opportunity to actually live within a culture of comfort and joy. Monsignor James Shea gave this compelling talk to a bunch of young adults last year, 2024, in front of 20,000 college students. And he simply said this. He drew the parallel with the following. He linked that there is a pervasive mental health crisis to lose There's a pervasive mental health crisis, and the reason there is a mental health crisis is because the world has lost these two things, which is comfort and joy. Comfort and joy. You guys know the song because you've probably heard it numerous times on the radio already. God rest ye merry gentlemen. You guys know that one? Can you sing with me? No, of course not. But I'm not going to sing it either. But it says, let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ our Savior was born on Christmas Day. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. Comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. Coming to you and talking to you about how to live the Christmas season seems like a very redundant thing. It seems like I shouldn't even have to give that. But the problem is that we live within a generation where stress and anxiety has completely hijacked comfort and joy. The natural response for a human being who was designed in the image and likeness of God, a human being whose very likelihood or livelihood is contingent on just being with God. But when you take God out of the equation of humanity, the natural response is for an individual to live with everything but joy, everything but comfort. Think of it as this. I don't know how many people like watch rugby. I know it's not exactly the most popular sport, right? But rugby, the predecessor of football, Simsbury Rugby. Holla. Rugby, the predecessor of football, is a little bit more combative. There is a point, and tell me when I'm wrong, or please correct me if I'm wrong, but there is a point in time where both teams will come together in almost a Fairlinks-like combative motion where they will ruck for the ball. And there's a point where the umpire would sit there before he actually throws the ball into this pile. He screams out, engage. And these two come in. Do they say engage? They come in and they battle for it. And essentially the low team wins. It's about driving. Very similar to football, but a little bit more forceful. Here we are, joy and anxiety are combating, they're combating, and who do we give the upper edge to? When we see a problem, we want to solve a problem. But first we got to eventually see a problem. And ultimately, that's where we have our biggest problem, is that we don't see it, but we feel it. And though we may not come to the recognition with our minds, our bodies are already telling the story. The white knuckling through life is already telling the story that maybe we aren't living a life of comfort and joy. That maybe the individuals that were created in the image and likeness of God, who God came and literally made you out of love for you, who promises you happiness and goodness, he has now been erased and stricken from the records of humanity, and now individuals believe that they can make themselves great without God's intervention. Phrases like self-made are thrown out there. I'm a self-made man. And to a certain extent, one's accomplishments can lead them to a point of achievement, but only to a certain extent. Because humanity has a glass ceiling. They can only go so far before they can't go any farther. And when individuals try to break that glass ceiling is when we see all sorts of evils. We see people try to take dignity from human beings by making other people look weaker. This is where wars break out and violence breaks out, because power is just very tempting. it's part of the human condition. I've been reading a lot of articles from Harvard Business Reviews, and there's a lot of talk about this emotional intelligence and the power of like responsibility and individuals who have power, how to make sure that they use their power in a very responsible way by looking at individuals that work under them with a sense of dignity and saying, let's speak and work with the people that work under us in a way that they will work with us. If business magazines can talk about this and say that this is a very successful tool, then why don't we function like this within our own Christian world? Fortune 500 individuals are reading the Harvard Business Review to sharpen up skills so that they can make better for themselves in either their trade or their corporation. And when you were, if you were to even read a Harvard Business Review article on how to make your business better, and like completely erase Harvard Business Review from it, change a few words here and there, it honestly sounds like the church speaking to its people on how to treat people under them. Fulton Sheen, Venerable Fulton Sheen, said that when the church stops talking about things, the world will hijack it. And when the world hijacks it, it gets to define it on its own. The world has now proposed to you, and I've read this on different psychological magazines and reviews, that what a world needs is hope. And now the world gets to define the terms of hope and says, hope in yourself. If you can hope in yourself, you will get yourself out of anything. If you think I'm kidding, look up the theories that people have come to like put together and send out in self-help books about self-manifestation. If you just envision it, you can make it happen. Well, I've been thinking about being skinny for years. It hasn't done anything if I don't go to a gym. I can't do it if I'm not going to eat right. Self-manifestation's flawed there already because I've already thought about it, but nothing's happening from it. Some people say get a vision board together. You want something manifested? Get a big poster board and put all the things that you want to do in it. Sweet. I want to look like Brad Pitt. I want to look by Brad Pitt by like next year. And I'm going to put all these pictures up there. And then I'm going to put it in my room. And every morning I'm going to look at it. And go, oh, one day I'm going to look like Brad Pitt. I'm still not going to the gym and I'm still not eating right, but I got a beautiful little vision board. Boston Celtics won the finals. Yes? Any Celtics fans? Yeah, sweet. All five of you. Congratulations. Coach had a vision board. Coach also walked around the court. I don't know if y'all know this. He would walk around the court an hour before anyone was to get to the TD Bank Arena, right? And he'd walk around with giant rosary beads, and he'd do a rosary around the court. Did y'all know that about Coach? Nah. Coach kept it real hush-hush. Coach vision board had all these things about what he was going to accomplish, and guess what was in the center of his vision board? The Sacred Heart of Jesus. And he said simply this, if I'm going to accomplish anything, it's got to go through him first. When the world starts defining things, you start buying into it. Guess what? The world tells you how to live your Catholicism. The world tells you what Catholicism is like. You got people from CNN and Fox telling you what Catholicism is like. You got people who aren't even Catholic telling you how to practice your Catholicism. And guess what we do? We eat that bad boy up like we had a Chinese buffet. And it's half off. And we're like, yeah, that's right. We should live Catholicism like this. We got to talk to Father. Things got to change. Bro, that's like listening to somebody who plays pickleball trying to tell me how to play football. I don't know if you know this, but like, maybe we should get it directly from the source. It says the following. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7. Cast all your worry upon him because he cares for you. We in our generation struggle with a lot of forethought. We struggle with a lot of foreseeing. We struggle with a lot of fortune and future and thinking of everything that is outside your actual human capable reach. And because of that, we end up worrying over and over and over again. The word worry, the etymology, the study of the word worry comes from an old Germanic word, worgen, which means to strangle. When we start to worry and worry and worry, we find ourselves getting stressed out. We find ourselves getting more anxious. We find ourselves not even really functioning within the best capability or within the best way in which we can function. I remember one game when I played high school football, and I wasn't even good, so this isn't going to be one of those, you know, great story where I ran all these yards, and I was a center, an offensive lineman. I snapped the ball, and I hit somebody in front of me, if there was somebody in front of me, and that's all I did. I wasn't even great at it. But I remember Coach Chesky one time going to the cafeteria, and he saw that his offensive linemen, it was an offensive line coach, his offensive linemen were eating a bunch of crap. And he lost his mind. He goes, you want to know why our quarterback is getting eaten up? Because y'all keep eating this. And he took our trays and he threw them out. And he went to the cafeteria lady and says, load their plates up with pasta. We're about to carb load these guys. They got a game tomorrow. Get them some pasta. Get them a salad. Get them a fruit. It was the best game we played. But you'd think we'd learn our lesson? No. We needed Coach Chesky to dump our plates before we realized that we were taking in all the wrong things. You and I are consuming the wrong thing. And we're not even preparing ourselves for the awesomeness which this season's going to bring, a true season of comfort and joy. And at the very center of that comfort and joy is hope. Your backpacks that y'all came in with says faith, hope, community. We all know about faith. In fact, it doesn't even take a religious person to have faith. A farmer plants a seed having faith that it's going to grow. A community, it doesn't take a religious group to get a group of people together. Anybody can have a group together. That, by definition, is community. But the one anchor within our faith that sets us apart from the rest of the world is the very thing that we deny, but the one thing we speak of because it's so cathartic, and it's hope. It's the one thing that anchors us to not worry about stuff and to hand our worries to Jesus Christ. It's the one thing that keeps us going. Hope is so powerful that it helps people with PTSD get over their traumatic responses. Hope is so powerful that it helps people with addictions overcome their addictions. Hope is so powerful that it can literally move individuals from a state of nowhere to a place of somewhere greater. I'm here because I want to propose something to this generation. There comes a point in time where one has to be confronted with the reality of the current state. The reality is that the CDC at one point in time said that we're on the precipice of a mental health crisis. Well, we ignore it and we ignore it and we ignore it. The CDC recently stated that the addictions to one smartphone have actually started to creep into health problems. But we've ignored it and ignored it and ignored it. To a point where, if you're not familiar with this, and we all do it, the term is called doom scrolling. We'll sit there for hours on end. I remember at one point in time, we used to watch Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy and actually get through the whole show. And now, I don't think we can, because we're doing this and looking up. Who is, oh crud, I missed the question. And we, how long will we ignore? Maybe I'm that crazy guy like John the Baptist who sits in a desert and I'm proclaiming, hey guys, there's hope in other things. Hey guys, don't hope in yourself. You're only setting yourself up for disaster. Maybe people think I'm completely antiquated. This old school thought, he still believes in fairy tales. No, I don't. I would even propose to say that individuals who oppose the thought that God is greater than anything else in this world actually lives more within a fantasy world than I do. I don't even have to debate it. There's people that live within a culture of debate. Let's come together and debate. No, I don't even have to debate it. Either God is good or you're delusional. We're very talented individuals. We're very smart individuals. Every single one of you here has a capability of changing the scope of life just based off of your raw talents, your natural responses to things. Some of you could probably outwit, outrun, outstrengthen. But I don't anchor myself in myself. I anchor myself onto the creator of all of heaven and earth. I anchor myself into the creator of this most, to me. I anchor myself onto God so that when the storms of life hit and they're going to rob me of my comfort and joy, my anchor has me held down and says, don't worry because I care for you, as it says in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7. Don't worry because I got you. As I transition to our next talk, we're going to give you guys a substantial little break. But I want you to kind of like think about something. Isn't comfort and joy something worth stopping and contemplating and saying, what would I actually live like if I truly had a sense of joy? What can I truly accomplish if I had a sense of joy? Now, don't get it. Can never take the kid out of Waterbury. But don't get it twisted. I'm not saying joy is us waking up in the morning and this slap happy, like whatever. It is what it is. No. Joy is something different. And it's powered by hope. And in our next talk, we're going to talk a little bit about that hope. So I want to give you guys a little bit of break, stretch break, snack break, do something to just maybe contemplate what we just talked about. And I'm going to stick around if anybody wants to talk to me about this first talk. God bless you.
Okay. We'll take about 15-minute break. We do have some refreshments out there. Bathrooms are down the hall, down there. So thank you. And guys, don't remember to genuflect, okay?
How was everybody's snack? Oh, no, this thing on. Hello, everybody. We are now officially back. Appreciate that. Hush came over the crowd. Thank you, Simsbury Rugby. Got the chuckles today, man. All right. If you guys wouldn't mind, when I talk about comfort and joy and not being stressed out, that is not to make as if I live this life that is void of stress, worry, anxiety, and all that stuff. I live within the same world that y'all live in. I'm not in some alternate universe where I stepped in through some sort of portal in which I am not affected by this stuff. I literally just finished the talk, and I get a text message from my wife, who's at Stop and Shop, and says, my car is not turning on. I have the kids. It's not even turning over. We're stuck in Stop and Shop. We're literally 2.5 hours away from our house and plan to drive home to Massachusetts tonight with a car that's not even working. Now, I could be freaking out right now or put my money where my mouth is. I called her up and she could be freaking out right now, but we put our money where our mouth is. Her father said one time, I never make a bet that I don't think I can win. So we're choosing joy and hope during a season where it's manifested truly through the liturgical season in a midst of something that can be stressful and anxiety provoking. So as you listen to this last part of the talk, know that, yes, I am even going through that whole physiological thing where I want to be able to do something, but I can't right now. Hope is not something that we say so flippantly. I will be in communications with her, so nobody freak out. I am an awesome husband, and she's right now, we got her connected with somebody. But there's nothing I can do. So we wait and hope. And her comfort is in that God will provide for those who give their worries up. We don't throw away hope. We don't talk about hope like any other thing. We talk about hope because it anchors everything down. I hope for you that this message in some way, shape, or form may impact the way that you live your life moving forward. But it's none of my business if it happens or doesn't happen. That's just my hope, something I can't see. There are two very different things that happen. Individuals tend to think that optimism is hope. Sometimes it's used interchangeably. An optimist, that's a personality, right? Do we have optimists in this room? One always sees that the glass is half full, right? I'm Eeyore. I always see the glass half empty. Like, oh, our time is so short. Melancholic, I think, is what they call those individuals. Is that right? I don't know, right? But I am that guy. So optimism is not a source of hope. It's just an attitude. It's a mindset. It's saying the words that it is what it is. Or you think of it in a more positive light. But even psychological reviews would say that optimism is not the same as hope because it lacks one thing. Action. An action plan. An optimist would look at the glass half full and be like, that's awesome. I don't need any more water. Until they need more water. We need an action plan. Hope provides That's disheartening. Sorry. Hearing my wife stuck in a siren, not a cool combination. Hope is disheartening. Hope is not disheartening. Stop and pray with me right now because I'm obviously distracted. I don't do this stuff for any other reason than I want to instill in individuals a part of themselves that no one's really tapped into. I get to talk to people from all around the world. I really do. And that's not to showcase that I'm any better than you. It's just an invitation that God has put to me, and I just answer yes every single time. I am not void of the stresses, the anger, the frustrations. I get easily frustrated when I know that I'm the brunt of someone's joke and I don't even know it. Like when you smile and you're joking under this, I get insecure and say, what did I do? My zipper must be down. Something's weird happening. When someone smirks or makes a joke, I'm insecure. It happens. I'm not void of any of this stuff. But the difference is my mindset is not anchored on myself. I'm not relying on myself to get myself out of any situation. I want to pass on to you a gift that really genuinely keeps giving. Hope is something that our Catholic Church has lost so much. In fact, hope is the one thing that reaches out to people who are either too theological that they forget to love or so loving that they forget about God. Hope is the one thing that brings people together, unifies them, and it says, hold up, come here. Hope is the man that sits on a cross and reaches out even when people mock, knowing that at the end of this invisible sense of future, there is something greater at the threshold once we cross it. My job is one of the most difficult, but most uplifting. I got to convince people of something that's super valuable. I get treated like a used car salesman when I'm giving you a Maserati. I really genuinely look at our church and I love every bit of it because she, in her beauty and her majesty, has been for me and been there for me every step of the way. Jesus Christ really took up his words and took up his cross specifically for me, just as he takes it up specifically for you. We come to faith formation and we hear all these things, and sometimes it might hit the heart. Sometimes it might go over our heads. Sometimes we might even ignore it. But I would challenge to tell you, or I don't even challenge it. It's a reality that hate isn't the opposite of love. My family, it's indifference. The opposite of love is indifference. When people approach Christ with an indifferent attitude, it's not a loving acceptance of Jesus Christ and his message. It's an attitude of, I know what's best for me, and that dude's just getting in my way. And what I say here, I say to other people. So please don't think that I'm talking specifically to the community in Simsbury. I talk specifically to a world that has now neglected the teachings of the Catholic Church, but yet still want to pick from the vine of the Catholic Church. No one agrees with the Catholic Church anymore, but still wants to send their kids to the private institution because they have a better chance at getting into 85% of the universities within the United States that happen to be Catholic. No one wants to follow and believe what the Catholic Church believes, but yet we want to enroll our kids to receive sacraments because we want to be a part of a community and don't want to be ostracized. We want them to meet their milestone mark like driver's licenses and proms. I don't speak to Simsbury. I speak to a community of people who struggle with the faith of the Catholic Church because it's been hijacked by a world that wants to define what the Catholic Church is, and none of them are really Catholic. They want to push hope, but don't have hope. They want to push love, but don't really know how to love. Hey, I'll tell you that the most loving thing you can do for somebody is look them in the eye and show them that they have dignity by talking to them and caring for them. I can tell you wholeheartedly that when I leave here today, I'm going to be sitting with our Lord, and I may not know your name, his name, their name, y'all names in the back, but I scan every single one of you, not because it's a public speaking technique, but I scan faces so that I can bring them in prayer, and then I bring it to our Lord and I say, hey, for the guy in the gray vest in the back, for the girl who's sitting right here, for the dude who snacked, you know, whatever, for my Simsbury rugby guy, like, I pray for y'all in the hopes that God does something beautiful in your lives. I don't need to know you to love you. The most loving thing that I can do for you is offer you up, but I am not, and I will never let a family member get behind a wheel when they've drank too much. I will never let a family member do a drug that's going to kill them. I will never let a family member stand in front of a railroad track when the train is coming. My love is not acceptance of what they do. My love is a call to action that says, hey, it's time to move. Hey, give me your keys. Hey, you don't need to numb the pain. A hope and optimism are not the same thing, because hope requires us to move, to have a sense of action, to say to ourselves, if I hope for something, then I will work for that something. I will gain that something, but I don't work alone. Because in the Gospels, it says that Jesus Christ is yoked alongside you. He will work with you. And his burden is light, because all of us are tired and need rest. I had a talk scripted that I wanted to give, but God shaking me and saying, no, give this instead. Because I'm worried for the hearts of the people who are perpetually wound tight. Their anxiety is now taking over the way that they do things, and yet the world keeps feeding them stuff that's just not nourishing. But we keep eating it because it's free and it's less threatening. My adults, I don't know if you realize how anxious this generation is. And I'm not talking about a generation as a whole. I'm talking about your sons, your daughters, their friends, your nieces, your nephews. They won't talk to you, and you know, because you ask them to talk to you, and they're going to filter their life so that you don't see the stuff that they're going through. But you'll notice because they pop off some way. They either ignore you or they give some sort of attitude, which is a sign that inside something's bottlenecked. And they may not tell you this, but studies are proving it over and over again that they're so stressed out about their future that it keeps them up at night. The average kid is going to bed close to 1, 2 in the morning, and it's not because they're like, they can be doom scrolling, but they're thinking. They can't shut it off half the time. To my adults in this room, I say it because I have 3 kids myself that I look at and I'm like, crud. My daughter was just at the mall and she's like, I'm tight right now. They don't know what to do with that emotion inside. And let's be real, to my adults, we don't even know what to do with that emotion inside. That emotion sometimes powers us to work harder. So I'm just going to put in more hours. Because if I put in more hours, then I'm going to be able to provide for a future. That stress is going to make you either isolate wife or isolate kids. It's going to make you want to rake leaves, and there's no leaves outside. My mom's, it's going to make you want to clean when there's nothing dirty anymore. You've dusted all you possibly can. You've done all the work you possibly could. You cooked everything you possibly can. Thanksgiving came. When Thanksgiving is done, everybody's stressed out and angry. And the last thing they are is thankful. The season of Advent happens. It's a season of joy and peace. And the last thing we feel is that joy and that peace. So to my adults, I talk to you first, because you're also thirsty for that hope that God wants to give you during this season. And this isn't a game. This isn't me trying to sell you anything. I'm not trying to get you to give more donations to the Catholic Church. I'm not asking you to go out there and do anything other than just be here. Can you receive our Lord in a different way? Because if you're feeling that way, then how are your neighbors feeling? The ones that don't attend with you. To this generation, this confirmation crew, you might be very accomplished and you might have a great resume being built up for your future careers. You might be someone that's on the National Honor Society. You might be a scholar athlete. You might have a lot of popularity, but why is it that you still struggle to even face yourself in the mirror, comparing yourself with other people? You post something and instantly want the gratification of somebody seeing you. All the while, God says, I see you, I have seen you, I will continue to see you. You don't have to filter. Before you even posted, I already gave you a heart, mine. Before you even did anything, I already gave you a like, me. You don't want your chat streak broken or whatever, but God is like, but why do you keep breaking it with me? God is trying to get to a point of realism with everybody to say, like, I am your comfort and joy, and we keep saying nothing. It can be very unpopular to step up and talk to people on how I think people should live their lives. I don't know how you should live your life. I really don't. I'm not a life coach. I don't know your career paths. I don't know your future desires. I don't know what you like. I don't know what you dislike. I don't know what your grades are. I don't know what your bank account is. I don't know what socioeconomic status you may live or may not live in. I don't know your political affiliation. I don't care about any of those things. All I care about is what Christ cares about, and it's your heart. Where is it? My daughter keeps watching The Grinch over and over again. And to a point of like, the house has now rebelled against her because she just wants to keep watching The Grinch. What movie do you want to watch, Veronica? The Grinch. What movie do you want to watch, Veronica? The Grinch. And in all honesty, it's starting to hit me in some sort of way, because the reality is that our world has a heart that has grown 3 times smaller. It doesn't even beat in the same fashion. And one of my favorite scenes of that movie is when they're chasing the Grinch down Whoville singing that very song that I started with. Do you know what I'm talking about? The new Grinch. And they almost do this West Side Story rendition when they're coming at him. You know, call me gentle, whatever. Why? Because this Grinch, whose heart is 3 times smaller, lacks the very thing that this song is asking for him to have, and it's comfort and joy. And my people, we all do. My wife keeps waiting for me to respond to her and tell her, what do I want for Christmas? I walked around the mall today trying to find what to tell her. I went to a sports store and I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'll have a New York Mets fan cave thing that I can put in my room to remind me of how big of a loser I am. I walked to one of the sneaker stores and I'm like, you know what? I heard that the Jordans are dropping this collaboration with Ferrari, and maybe I want one of those. Maybe the Black Cats when they come out. And then I looked at the price tag and I'm like, $500 for a pair of sneakers? I don't know about that. Then I went to a watch store and I saw this beautiful watch with like a little sapphire thing at the very top. It had no numbers around the dial. It was just all gold. I was like, oh, maybe that watch, that's slick. I said, how much is that? They're like, $2,000. I said, for what? Doesn't even have numbers. I got a guess at the time. And I'm not going to lie. I don't even know what to tell my wife what I want for Christmas. But you know what my heart is longing for? An individual who can live their day full of peace and joy. True comfort and joy. And today, I'm actually living a sense of that because of the hope that God's going to give it to me on Christmas Day more than I've ever, ever had. I'm a simple guy that just needs a simple thing. I don't want to try to convince you of anything. I shouldn't have to convince you when our God already gave his life for you. But I do want to open your eyes to let you know that the way that you have been living is just falling short of greatness. I want to share something really personal, and I don't want to go over time, so I grew up in a world where I thought that I wasn't worth much. I grew up in a world thinking that an individual shaking the cockroaches out of his cereal boxes were normal. That receiving government cheese was normal. That receiving powdered milk was normal. I grew up thinking that the way that I lived my life was just normal until I realized this is not. This is not normal. I went on that Steubenville retreat, and I tell you, and this is not a plug for it, man. It's really not. But I went on this retreat, and I heard somebody tell me that I was made for greatness. And it stuck with me so much that it changed a lot about me. God knows best the plans that he has for your life. When I came back from the retreat, guess what? My cereal didn't magically not have roaches in it. My dad's bank account didn't magically get bigger. Angels didn't come swarming down to protect me from the gangs that jumped me because I was in the wrong neighborhood. No, life continued, but you know what happened with me? My heart was anchored to something greater than me in that moment. And every day I woke up and I believed what that guy said. I am made for greatness because God, he created me for greatness. Not just for happiness, not just for niceties. He created me for goodness. I'm not content with being a nice guy and doing churchy things. I'm not content with that. That bar is very low, my friends. Anybody can hand a sandwich to someone who's hungry. It takes some time to sit with that person and talk to that person and bring that person from the midst of obscurity and poverty into something greater. That's where greatness lies. Anyone can do these simple things that are nice. But I know that God was calling me to something greater because someone proclaimed it to me. A stranger proclaimed it to me, and I believed it. And when I went to my guidance counselor and I said, I think that I'm going to go to college, she laughed at me, people. She thought she was hiding the smirk, and you could see it a mile away. And then the words that she said next took me by surprise, and I didn't realize it until I was an adult that they were more offensive than I actually took it at the moment. But she says, your people don't go to college. They work really hard. And I believed her. And after college, I worked 3 jobs. Until I realized in the middle of one job, during the middle of one shift, that I was made for greatness. And I called somebody up and I said, you know what? I'm taking action. And I'm going to go to that university that I went to when I was 15 years old, and I first heard the message that I'm called for greatness, and I'm going to go to this university, and I'm going to say that I want to be a part of this university, and I'm going to show people that little inner city obscure nobody that didn't believe much can happen to him can actually make something of himself. And I went to that university, and you know what they said? No. They go, what are your SAT scores? I didn't take them. What are your ACT scores? I didn't take them. Have you been to college before? No. They said, we can't in good conscience accept you. You haven't even applied. And I told the individual, why is it that I came to a Catholic university and I'm the only one with the Catholic faith? I went home. Me and my friend drove home 14 hours. I ended up getting home late on a Monday, only to receive a voice message that this university was going to accept me on a provisional status. We'll accept you as long as you keep your grades up. I went to this university after 1.5 years, I failed. And was so embarrassed to come back to Waterbury, Connecticut, that I stayed out in Ohio. And I worked as a calf worker, and I lived in a project house, and I found myself after the cafeteria was closed, taking the food that they threw out in the dumpster and bringing it home so I can provide for myself, shaking the cockroaches out of the box was a luxury compared to what I was living when I was in Steubenville. But nobody ever saw that because they saw a man who lived with comfort and joy. I smiled at every opportunity I got to grow in my greatness, even in the midst of more obscurity and more struggle. And after 10 years of being stuck in Ohio, my friend died in Waterbury. A friend that came with me through the retreats and did all the things ended up dying, and I'm stuck in Ohio. Too embarrassed to go back home and show people that I failed. And then God reminded me of the message that he told me from the get-go. You were made for greatness. But not on your time, bro. On my time. And guess what? It was his time when I had that prayer, 10 years after the fact. I met this woman. We danced. We talked. I found out she was from Connecticut. Said, no way, I'm from Connecticut. Where in Connecticut? She goes, Portland, Connecticut. Never heard of it. Do you know Middletown? Yes, somewhere around there. We end up talking. Our relationship gets very serious. I end up going to a family function. They start opening up albums, photos, pictures. They pick up an album that says Steubenville Reunion on it. And I'm like, you've been to Steubenville? She goes, get out of here. You went on a retreat too? I go, yeah, I went on a retreat. That's why I went to Steubenville. She opens up the album and there's a picture of me and her on stage. When we were teenagers, and the first time I met her was at this university. Today, I celebrate 14 years of the moment I proposed to my wife. All the struggles that I've been through, I'll go through it all over again if it means that I'm going to meet that woman again. And the irony behind all of it is that the first time I went to that retreat in 95, I wanted to collect all these phone numbers, and all the while, God had one phone number in mind. He was just holding hers. Guys, I don't play games when I say that God will come through for you. And today, this kid who was not meant for college graduated Franciscan University with a 3.3 GPA. I went on to get my master's at St. Leo's University in Florida with a 3.4 GPA. I'm currently contemplating whether I'm going to do my doctorate in theology. He's taken me all around the states to different countries around the world, Barcelona, Lisbon, Barbados. the possibility of me even going to Australia to bring the gospel. This kid who grew up with a speech impediment, with nobody from the inner cities of Waterbury, Connecticut, is now knocking on people's hearts and saying, do you know Jesus? He's the source of my comfort and joy. I am not trying to sell you anything. Some of you probably already have enough. I'm presenting you a free and awesome gift that Jesus Christ gives freely with his life. And that's a message of hope to bring you tidings of comfort and joy. I appreciate you guys so much. Thank you for your time, for your patience, for your respect. God bless you. Said she probably shouldn't turn off the car. So she's. No,
you
she.
Go get her?
My, no, thank you so much. My brother-in-law ended up meeting her. He turned it over. She's probably in the parking lot and said that he just suggested keep it on.
Yeah.
So.
We'll
be available later. Yeah, we'll handle it when we get there, right, hopefully. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Later, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
I didn't really mean to, correct that kid's name. It sounded kind of rude.
You're good, man. You're good. I appreciate you,
though. That was actually really good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a great speech.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Thank you for doing that. It's brave of you for getting up there talking.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, you want to
her. Thank you. Thank you.
It's hard talking to teenagers.
Oh.
No response.
It's okay.
Nice job,
thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Are we all hoping that your wife's okay?
Yeah, she actually just texted me and said she got. He's still within.
He's all in
there.